So the purpose of my talk is to review some ideas that we have recently developed to solve problems in general relativity using techniques borrowed from effective theories in particle physics, and if you want, like quantum gravity approach, like perturbative quantum gravity approach around Minkowski background, but not necessarily Minkowski one kind. That's perturbations around any particular solution of Einstein equation. And if you recognize that picture, that's taken from Tony C's book, Quantum Field Theory in a Nutshell. And when he describes like effective field theories or quantum field theory altogether, this is the way he talks about like parameterizing our ignorance about the part of the physics that we don't know. And this is pretty much what we're going to do in this talk. We're going to parameterize the ignorance about part of the dynamics that we don't know in terms of the degrees of freedom that are relevant for the dynamics that we're interested in. So let me do some self-promotion first. So the idea here is basically solving classical problems using Feynman diagrams, so using techniques borrowed from QFT. If I have some time later on, I'm going to show how one can actually reduce the amount of work, the amount of Feynman diagrams by using like techniques by using like techniques like also borrowed from particle physics. Like we recently learned that one can reduce the amount of work in Feynman diagrams using like the spinor representation. Well, I want to work that not exactly that type of representation, but similar decomposition on the field could help you to reduce the amount of work. So what is this effective field theory idea? So the first paper on the subject was put forward by Walter Goldberg and Ira Ruskin when they studied the non-spinning case. So what we're interested in is solving for the problem of motion, meaning let's imagine we have two black holes or neutron stars with some characteristic size RS, and there's some distance R, and this is a binary system. So this moving at some typical velocity V. So the idea of using effective field theory techniques to solve the problem of motion and gravitational radiation in this setting was originally studied by Walter and Ira. I studied the spinning case, so imagine now that you have some spinning. So this ball is allowed to spin. I don't want to use my right hand. And eventually, once the theory was put forward, we immediately computed new results for the case of the spinning bodies, and next to in order. And that was done by, in collaboration with Ira in this paper. The next-to-next-to linear order results were also computed by Gilmore and Ross recently. And one can include higher order effects and keep on going, and I'm going to show how these things can be put forward to develop post-Newtonian corrections to all orders in the velocity. One can also study dissipation and absorption. The non-spinning case was studied by Ira and Walter, and I did the part which is for spinning black holes. One can also study the cell force, something that was studied by Kylie and Hu. And this is like two reviews on the subject. So this is just pretty much the literature. So as I was trying to explain before, we have three different scales in this problem. One is the size of the object, one is the distance between these two bodies, and the velocity. So we have three different scales. It's the size scale, which has modes 1 over RS, which is like basically what's happening inside the neutron star of the black hole. Then we have modes which are order 1 over R, so the potential, the typical momentum is 1 over R. That's what we call potential modes, which are responsible for the binary layer of the binary system. Notice that these are optional modes, like for instance, they will be responsible for the Newtonian potential that they didn't know that. And then we have the radiation mode, which is this, the other scale, lambda, which is much larger scale of the radiation because there is some typical frequency, some typical wavelength of the radiation of the binary system. So these are the typical on-shell modes, which is order V over R, so typical momentum for this gravitons is order V over R. So if we want to solve the problem of motion here, what we have to do is solve Einstein equations. We need some stress and tensor for the sources. we have to compute the metric, go to the far zone, and compute the radiation. This is very complicated, because we have very different scales playing at once. So this is what effective field theory is basically tailor-made for. We want to separate each scale at a time and construct a tower of effective field theories that would allow us to solve the problem of motion systematically, one scale at a time. And therefore, we're going to construct a series of effective field theories that will describe each one of these scales separately. And eventually, we're going to be able to compute post-Newtonian corrections, meaning we're going to be able to compute the radiation and the power spectrum at each order in the velocity, including the effects of the motion of the bodies, the quadrupole induced by the motion, the finite size effects, absorption, dissipation, etc. As you can imagine, if you're going to solve Einstein equations with all these scales played at once, it's a very complicated set of equations. And in fact, the state of the art is one post-Newtonian is b squared. So this is pretty much how we count corrections to the leading order, like the Newtonian dynamics. So we know one post-Newtonian, for instance, the equations of motion for the bodies to one post-Newtonian order was computed by Einstein, Ife Hoffman, back in the 38. Then 2pn was computed b to the 4. This was Chandra, Seca, around the 70s. And then there is 3pn, which was recently computed. And this is a group by Damour, Blanchet, and others, more in the 90s. And the complications in the method that they developed are clear from the beginning, because one runs all sorts of difficulties when one studies GR equations that have non-linearities. And the way they develop they solve these equations by treating the sources as point particles. So one has like delta function sources in GR. One knows they have to regularize the theory properly. One runs into all sorts of problems. They regularize in a very complicated way and eventually come up with a solution. From the effective field theory point of view, the regularization is going to be straightforward, because the divergences are going to be due to the fact that we're going to shrink this to a point particle. We're going to use the point particle approximation. So obviously, we're going to have UV divergences, but those UV divergences are cut off by the size of the object. So all we have to do is have an effective field theory approach. We regularize the theory by including all possible highly dimensional operators. So this is the basic idea. So this is just some phenomenology. Why is this useful for? So this is not just something we do in paper. Eventually, this is going to be measurable. So computing the power spectrum, the gravitational waves coming off the binary system is going to be relevant for LIGO physics, for instance. So this is the typical scales. That is the frequency band for LIGO. So there's some typical numbers for the separation, the typical orbit separation between the bodies would be for 1 kHz or 10 hertz. What's the typical velocity? So we can see that we can use the post-Newtonian approximation, where we're expanding in B over C is much less than 1. And we're going to see that even though it takes like about 5 minutes for black holes, Newton's down order, the solar mass, there's many, many, many cycles. So in principle, it's very important to have the more accurate the waveform, the better, to extract, to do precision tests of astrophysics tests, right? To extract, for instance, the spin of the bodies, the masses of the bodies, etc. So what are we doing? What is the effective field theory approach? So we're using techniques borrowed from quantum gravity, basically, like do perturbation around flat space. These objects, so masses, which are order of the solar mass. So we're going to use a perturbation around flat space time, which is denoted as the post-Newtonian approximation. So what we're going to do is we're going to solve from the Lagrangian point of view, meaning we're going to solve Einstein equations by doing the path integral, by looking for the saddle point. So we're going to do the classical path integral. Meaning we're going to compute effective action by integrating out all the modes responsible for the interaction, all the gravitational modes. So eventually we're going to construct an effective action that's going to be only a function of the wavelengths of the particles. That effective action is going to have two pieces. Those pieces are going to be responsible for the equation of motion, which is the real part of effective action, which is going to work as a Lagrangian. And it's going to have an imaginary part, because there is some decay energy here, which is radiated into infinity, and that's the power spectrum. So eventually, the information about the physics in the system is all in the path integral, it's all in the effective action. We're not going to introduce quantum effects, so this is going to be all classical, all three level. So that's why we said it's a subtle point approximation, but the techniques are exactly equivalent. The only difference, we're going to be using the same techniques, we're going to talk about gravitons, we're going to draw Fermion diagrams. The only difference is we're not going to have loops. So this is different from what Donahue, for instance, computed, the first quantum corrections due to quantum loops, graviton loops. The idea is similar, but we're not going to include loops because this is a purely classical problem. But we're going to organize our calculations similarly. So how do we start? So let's ignore dissipation for the time being. So the first effective field that we have to construct is how we're going to deal with the size of the object. So that's pretty much the setting. We're going to solve Einstein equations in the presence of the sources, which are the binaries of the black holes. And we want to compute eventually what is the power spectrum, what is the radiation. Yes?
A very simple question.
Yes.
You said it. So is it just known astrophysically that there won't be stuff in between the two bodies that could create, well, they're in spiraling, right? You think there'd be stuff, I mean, how do you define
the size?
Yes, they
could. Let's say we have some domain, some compact domain where this matter,
yes,
right? And that distance, whatever you want to call it, like r, big r, and then some other distance r. So in the approximation that we're working at, like r over r is not much less than much. So it's true that in principle you can have like a fluid dynamics. And eventually these techniques could work exactly the same way. You can separate them in pieces and do some Lagrangian interaction between fluids. And in fact, we have some idea how to use that, for instance, in cosmology, right? How to compute corrections like star formation, like structure formation and things of that nature. But in this case, I have two isolated bodies where what defines the body as such, right? The distance power is much, much less than the separation. So these are the cases that the binary black holes, for instance, right? The binary black hole, there is nothing left after all the process that created the black hole, right? Mm-hmm. You have two black holes, they have mass and spin. They sucked everything up, and whatever is left is just two black holes, right?
Okay, so they don't have a large enough disk that...
They could overlap. Well, but that would be a different theory, yes.
Yeah.
Okay, good question. So how do we treat, construct our first effective theory, which is how do we treat these bodies which have some structure?
Wouldn't you need more chalk over there?
No. This. So how do we construct an effective theory that would allow us to treat these bodies in the four particle approximation, like consistent? Now, why are we allowed to use the point particle approximation? Well, intuitively, as I said before, there's this separation of the scales. We have R, if you think about black holes, like R Schwarzschild, other M, which is much, much less than R, much, much less than lambda. Right? So it's up to be some kind of perturbation approach where we can systematically include one scale at a time. Right? So the first obvious scales is R over R, which is much, much less than 1. So we're going to construct effective theory with an expansion parameter that's going to be bigger over smaller. So what kind of effective theory is that? It's like a single body, a unique single body with some size R, coupled to some wavelength lambda, some gravitons, which are ordered R. Or some frequency omega, which is all the one over R. So we're going to make an expansion where omega R is much, much less than 1. So we're going to probe this object with some frequency. It's a long wavelength approximation. This is going to look like a point particle. And when we're going to put this in the binary, this probe is going to be the other guy producing this graviton mode. So our first free theorem is an expansion in order much, much less than one. So what do we have? Well, this is sort of described here. So the first effective theorem that we have is we're going to integrate all the modes which are responsible for the short distance physics. So we're going to get rid of all the short distance physics, meaning all the matter fields plus all the gravity modes inside the object. So there is some modes here responsible for the gravity modes, like if it's a black hole, like quasi-normal modes. And if you have a neutron star, you have some matter modes as well. So we're going to get rid of all of those, because we don't see those at the scale r that we probe in the system. So at that order, this looks like a point particle. So in principle, this is like what I call like shrinking the black hole in the long wavelength limit. In principle, we don't really know what's happening here. We don't know the question of state of the neutron star, for instance. But we don't have to, because from the effective theory point of view, all we have to know is what are the symmetries of the system. So what kind of symmetries we have? Well, in the low wavelength approximation, this is that GR coupled to some T mu nu, so it obeys diff invariance. So we know once we integrate out all the dynamics inside the neutron star, the effective action that we're going to generate is going to be a point particle approximation plus all possible terms compatible with the symmetries. And what kind of symmetries we have here is diffeomorphism invariance. So the type of terms that we can write down is proportional to the curvature. So we have, for instance, rich scalar like tensor and higher order terms. So this is effective theory one. The idea is to treat the bodies in the point particle approximation, and what we're gonna do, this goes up. No. Huh? Oh, there's one in between. How do you get to that one? Ah. This is very cool. But this one doesn't work. Okay. So this guy is going to go to a point particle. So we're going to have a point particle action. But it's going to induce higher order terms due to the fact that there is some size. Right? And those higher order terms are going to be encoded in this Wilson coefficient. So we have a point particle. We have some m d tau plus, let's say, which is c like r d tau plus, let's go cr cv r mu nu x dot nu d tau plus blah, blah, blah. So for effective field theories, this is trivial, right? I mean, you have a theory. You don't know what the short distance physics is. So what? We just include all the possible terms which are compatible with the symmetry at higher order. So these guys are going to be suppressed in the long wavelength limit. They're going to be some power of omega r, which is much, much less than 1. So it's a very well-defined multiple expansion. So
R and CV are finite. Because if I do it honestly and
no, it's not going to be okay. That's the whole point. There's some piece here which is going to have all the 1/4 to regularize the point particle approximation. I'm going to show you that in a second. So this is going to absorb all the divergences, because when shrinking to a point, all the dots that are going to be cut off because you have an R, it's going to blow up. It's going to be absorbed into this C. So the first thing that we notice right away is like, wait a second, this guy vanishes on shell. So Einstein equation tells me that r mu nu is equal to 0. That's, we have a black hole, right? Actually, it's identical 0 for black holes, right? There is no delta function source. All these delta functions that we are putting here, on this leading order term, if you write this as a bulk action, it's a delta function, it's fictitious. It's not really there, right? So what do we really know is that these terms here that we can construct, which are compatible by the symmetry, they vanish by the equation of motion. So what we can do is get rid of them by field redefinition. So this is standard technique in field theory. We can always redefine our fields in such a way that all the physics that is independent of when we compute the power spectrum, we didn't know what kind of metric we use, what kind of G mu nu field we use to interpolate. So we can redefine our fields in such a way that we can get rid of these terms, because they are proportional to the linear order equations of motion. So we can always redefine chi mu nu, it's going to produce some variation in the Lagrangian, which is going to be equation of motion times dg. And equation of motion is here. So we just have to put a minus sign here, and this is going to cancel this term. Right? So these terms, even though they are there, they are not physical because they vanish on shell. We can get rid of them. So the next term that can contribute are terms which are curvature squared. And I'm writing now these terms in terms of the electric and magnetic component of the bulk tensor, because I can take away all the R mu and R pieces of the R. If you take the Riemann tensor, we can decompose it into the electric and magnetic components, which is similar to what if I left mu nu, one can always write E and B. Because we get rid of all the part which is like reaches that. So we can always write this, think of this as like curvature squared, which you cannot get rid of by field definition. So these are the first non-trivial terms that will contribute now to the equation of motion that you cannot read by field definition. I'm going to be responsible for finite size of them. So now answering your question, you see, for instance, you have this effective theory, which is a point particle approximation. Let's say you want to compute the field produced by this particle. Then you have a bunch of diagrams. So you have the Newtonian potential, then you have correction due to nonlinear interactions, and then when you go to higher order, then you realize because of the nonlinear interaction, because gravity basically dresses up itself, don't confuse yourself, this is not a loop, this is not a propagating degree of freedom. We're treating the wall line, the M as external source, it's gravity coupled to external source. M is very large, right? So M over M Planck, even though it's very large, we are treating the particles as external sources, so our expansion parameter is going to turn out to be the angular momentum, mvr, which is going to be order 1. This is, in our action, this term is going to be order L, mvr, this is very easy to see from here. A higher order corrections are going to, like if you span the detail, for instance, you're going to generate order these four terms. This guy is going to be a sum where each term is going to have some order v. So our expansion is going to be some large number, but so what? It's the leading order term. Higher order correction are going to be done by this point. And some of those B-square corrections, when if you put here this guy in a binary, are going to come from gravity interactions, because we have the Wheeler theorem. Remember, the B-square is all the R squared over R. So powers of R are also powers of B. But here I know nothing about the binary. All I'm doing here is like computing the metric in this theory where I have a point particle plus highly dimensional terms. And then you see just the point particle approximation here will produce these nonlinearities, and those are not really propagating the degrees of freedom, so you can take an external source, so this is our leading order. Then we have this term, and then a higher order. We have this term, and so on. So these are all three-level diagrams. So all the three-level can, there's no, even though there is a loop here, it's not really a loop in the sense that there are leftover intervals in momentum. This integral here is the one that is going to have the poles. It's not going to be, it's not, the reason why there is a 1 over epsilon pole that I did right here. Well, this guy has a 1 over epsilon pole. The reason that there is a pole is because this is a point particle approximation. It's going to sink all the momentum, so you're going to sum all possible wavelengths up to infinity, because this is going to shrink to a point particle. So you have all the UV physics, and that's what's going to produce the divergences. There's no loop divergence in the graviton. There's a divergence because we're treating this as a standard point particle. So there you go. When you compute the metric, then you realize that you run into divergences, and then you see that there's a counter term with a term which is going to be proportional to these two operators that I mentioned before. So those guys are going to have the 1 over epsilon pole to regularize the theory. Since those guys can be redefined away, what that means is that those divergences are not really physical. There is no really finite size effect. One can show that actually these divergences, because there is here the four graviton, is a 3 pn, like a b to the sixth. And originally, we thought that there would be like a finite size effect of b to the sixth, but it's not true because one can theoretically find those away. So these are not really physical, which suggests that there's a gauge where these divergences probably don't show up and everything is finite. But those guys are going to show up at a much higher order, though, and they are physical. So these guys do contribute to the equation of motion. You cannot get rid of them. So the whole point is here in the effectively zero approach, what is the order at which this guy starts? And it's going to start contributing to the equation of motion, and it's going to produce like finite size corrections to the orbit.
Excuse me.
Yes?
I'm confused about your
question. Yes, good.
What you consider is a strong gravitational field, but why you can use the flat spacetime from diagram to for your calculation?
Oh, we're assuming that this approximation, well, these are small black holes, right?
So small black holes?
Yeah, like order the mass of the sun and the distance, the separation. So this is perturbation around flat space. There's a standard post-Newton. This is not like a big black hole and you have a point particle orbiting around it. Then you have to do perturbation around the background, which is curved. Here, this small black hole, or the mass of the sun, very far away, like it's pretty flat, right? So this is really around flat space. This guy propagates around flat space. I'm not taking into account that this guy could, the propagation here is completely flat. I'm not taking into account it's carried off the curvature, for instance. That would be much more complicated. Okay. So how do we get this guy? So the first non-trivial finite size effect entered from this operator. So it's clear what the idea is. We are using effective zero theory, meaning, okay, let's write down an action that is compatible with the symmetry that has all possible terms that you can write down. You do the same in gravity. You have r mu, you have root gr, like then you have r squared, and some people even want to have 1 over r, and things like that. So this is exactly the same. So we are parameterizing the ignorance about the finite size structure by including these towers of higher dimensional operator. Well, what am I doing this if this is an infinite tower? Well, because we have a control expansion. We have a parameter, which is b, that it's going to be b, but in this case, it's the prob, the frequency of the prob, which is in this case some lambda, or some frequency omega, times, r. So we have a well-defined expansion with the finite size effect is going to scale up some power of r. It's going to be some power of the size of the object, and that's what I'm going to show in a second. When we put this guy into the field produced by the other binary, this guy now has power of r, because the Baryer theorem is going to be some power of v, and you can power cut. And it turns out that this guy starts at v to the 10. So then we have a theorem 1. First finite size effects in the binary system starts at v to the 10. So finite size effect starts at v to the 10. And that's why these people, especially recently, I mean, they didn't know all our techniques, but like when they can do 3 p.m., 4 p.m., up to 5 p.m., one can treat the bodies as point particles. Because this is the proof, because the terms will correct the point particle approximation and it will deviate from geodesic motion, starts at order b to the 10. And how do we know that? It's because we have to do the matching. Because effective theory gives you a way to systematically parameterize your ignorance, but doesn't tell you what C is. It does tell you what the short distance physics calls into C to regularize the theory, but there's a leftover piece that you have to renormalize. So eventually there's going to be an RG group, so you have to match. You have to know this guy at some scale. And the scales that you're going to merge at is R, or R squared, if you want. So how do we do the match? So that's the next idea.
So this result holds only for black holes or also for
neutrons? No, this is general. That C is well, okay. I'm assuming spherical symmetry. I'm going to talk about spin in a second. Here, this is there's no multiples, right? If there are multiples, you have more terms. But this is completely general. This has to do just with the symmetries of the theory. This is the beauty about having symmetries, right? I don't care what the short distance physics is. I know the long distance physics symmetries. I know a standard model, right? I don't know what string theory symmetries are.
If you have multiples, then the power is...
This gets modified if you have multiples. And I'm going to show you that in a second. What do we say? I'm going backwards. Matching. So how do we do the matching? So now if this, so what am I telling you? I mean, you should stop and say, okay, you have these unknown coefficients like CE and CV. So you don't know what they are, right? So how are you going to solve for them? So if you're going to solve the whole problem of motion to get these coefficients, you did nothing, right? The good thing about these coefficients is that they're universal. You measure somewhere these coefficients, you get those values, and then you use them wherever you want in any other problem. And that's the magic of effective theory. You get some numbers, you measure some numbers, and CKM matrix. You get some numbers, you go to measure somewhere else, you get the same physics. So this is the same. It's the same effective theory there. So how do we get these numbers? Well, you can go and measure something. Or if you know the full theory, you do matching. This is what you do, for instance, and it's very similar to what you do in HQD or in RQCD, if some people know what I'm talking about, because you know what QCD is. So how do you do the matching here? Well, you don't have to solve for the full problem, because this is effective theory for particle 1, effective theory for particle 2. How this guy reacts to this graviton doesn't care whether this is coming from whatever, from another body, from nothing. All it cares is how it reacts to gravity here. It's a local theory. So how do we do the matching? It's just, okay, let's compute these coefficients, which are some response coefficients to some interaction. So what kind of interaction point can we compute? Okay, let's compute something simple. Let's do graviton scattering. So let's compute graviton scattering of a black hole. So we don't have to solve the whole problem of motion. We just need to know how the guy is going to react to some external field. It could be some graviton. So let's compute the scattering in the full theory. Computing the scattering up into the full theory means you have to solve the equation here, like in GR, blah, blah, blah. You're going to compute some cross-section. Therefore, this is a hard problem, but much simpler than solving the whole problem of motion in the binary case. So once this problem is known, actually, people know what the solution to this is, even numerically. When I have some full theory cross-section, it's going to have this form. Imagine you have a black hole. The only scale they have around is R Schwarzschild. So it's going to be proportional to some area. So it's R Schwarzschild square. And then it's going to be some dimensionless number, which is some frequency omega for the graviton. It's going to be some function of omega RS. Now we are in the limit where the effective theory is valid, which means omega RS is much, much less than 1. We can expand. There's going to be a term, which is going to be some frequency to the eighth. Then when computing effective theory, there's going to be a bunch of terms, also terms with just gravity coupled to gravity itself. But there's going to be some interaction. It's going to be, it's carrying off of this higher dimensional operator because it has two gravitons, two legs. And there's going to be some contribution effective theory that we can isolate, which is in the amplitude, which is called linear with C, but goes C squared in the cross-section, which is going to have four powers in the amplitude because it has two derivatives in each. So it's four powers, but square is eight powers. And then we have the full theory calculation, the effective theory calculation. We compare, and we get what the value of this guy is. And then we see it goes like five powers of the size of the object. And like I told you before, due to the Virial theorem, you know, it was like D square. So 5 powers of this guy is 10 powers of B. And that's B to the 10, intuitively. So this is how you do the matching. You don't have to solve for the full problem. You just solve a problem that you know how to solve. You get these coefficients, they are universal, put them in the binaries, and now we have C1 and C2. In a binary system, we can make a prediction. Because now we know what the values of these guys are. So you could compute, in principle, finite size corrections due to these guys in the waveform. Now, imagine you have a different theory, and it's not a black hole, it's a neutron star. You compute the scattering of the neutron star. You have these numbers, you compute an effective theory, you extract these guys, and then you have a way of testing whether your model for the theory is right. You can use gravitational waves to actually probe the inner structure of the neutron star. Unfortunately, that's very small. Although for neutron stars, you can have them in Hessler because you can have a factor 3, 4, 5 here in the size, and remember it's to the fifth. So that could have a very large number. So it's not obvious that it's not relevant for neutron stars. Okay, is there any question so far? This is, yes?
So you mean if I use scatter field to scattering around black hole, according to what, so you will obtain the same confession for the...
No, but that depends, okay. You can construct a theory where you have a tensor scalar of gravity, for instance. Imagine that, right? And then you can construct highly dimensional operators that also couple to the scalar field. And then you can do the matching, yes. Yes. Like in this case, I'm just, my external field is gravity, just pure gravity. There is no scalar or anything. But you could, in principle, use this to study modified gravity. Like you tensor scalar gravity, so any other theory of gravity. Bose-Newtonian corrections. You could compute Bose-Newtonian and finite size. The thing is that already an next-to-linear order or linear is already constrained. So if you go to higher order, then the correction is going to be tiny. Okay. So this is our first theory. This is how we deal with the finite size of the bodies. Okay, so let's see the question, right? What happens if you have multiples? So one of the multiples that we can have is spin. Now, more self-promotion. This is highly non-trivial to introduce spin in GR. Because if you ever read like papers on how to introduce spin in full GR, it's complicated, to say the least. And for us, we want to construct a Lagrangian because we're going to compute the path interval. So we have to deal with some degree of freedom that is going to be responsible for rotation. So I'm going to tell you the end of the story. The end of the story is that one can construct not exactly a Lagrangian, but something that looks like a Lagrangian that works, that is called Arusian. That works as a Lagrangian for the Wallerstein degrees of freedom for the position, but it works as a Hamiltonian for the spin. And the most general way to introduce the coupling of a spin to gravity is through the spin connections. And then one can show that this term will give you at linear order the equations of motion that come from that Roussian or Lagrangian plus Hamiltonian for spin are equivalent to the Papapetro equations, which are the equations that in the curved space-time, schematically, these are Papapetro equations. I'm not putting indices, but you know what I mean. So this Lagrangian slash Roussian is equivalent to this equation of motion. So when people in Bose-Newtonian tries to solve the equation of motion in terms of spin, they have to solve these equations. And it becomes highly non-trivial, especially when one includes non-linearities in spin, like spin-spin couplers. Because then you have to solve Einstein equation G mu coupled to some stress energy tensor and compute this spin component to this guy. So this becomes a mess. For us, it's much simpler because we just have new Feynman rules. We just have a new coupling to gravity. We're going to run into all sorts of divergences, but now we have a new term to regularize those divergences. For instance, something that looks like a quadruple. And if you think about it, this is some S squared quadruple type interaction, right? This is like a P dot E type of term in electromagnetism. This is nothing but the Kerr quadruple of the black hole. If you compute This coupling contributes to the one-point function. So if you compute, for instance, that's a new term, C, computing one-point function, it's going to be proportional to S squared. It's going to have some coefficient C. So the matching in this case is much simpler because since this guy couples to the one-point function, it couples directly to it contributes to the metric. Our previous guy, something that I didn't mention, our previous guy, this guy does not contribute to the one-point function because it has two legs. If you're going to close it, you have a loop, and we are not doing loops. And it's good. Sorry?
Why doesn't there exist an effect of Lagrangian? Why do you have this weird thing about
you can do it. You can do it, but it becomes complicated because then you need. So what you do is you put some rotation degrees of freedom. So you put a tetrad field on the wall. And then you define the rotation of that tetrad in the local frame. And then you construct a Lagrangian in terms of the angular velocity defined in terms of this guy, which is E. So you have some Lagrangian in terms of this. And then you can vary the tetrad and get the equations of motion. The problem is that you have to identify what you mean by spin. And the spin is a momentum. So it becomes the omega, it becomes spin. So it's a P. So you want to have something that at the end of the day is an equation of motion in terms of something which is a momentum, it's a P. And that's why using this mixture of Hamiltonian and Lagrangian is much simpler. At the end of the day, I don't care. I get some equations of motion, which is what's important. But you could do everything in terms of E and E dot, and then at the end recognize what you mean by spin, and you get the same answer. There's another subtlety when we deal with spin in GR, is because it's a constraint system. It has second class constraints. The problem is that we have way too many degrees of freedom here. So we just need a three vector in the rest frame, right? And we have a whole tensor, we have six, we have to three. So we have to impose constraints. So usually what people do is impose something which is called spin supplementarity condition, which is a set of constraints that reduces the amount of degrees of freedom. These are second class constraints. So if you were to impose this in your Lagrangian, then you end up with a Dirac algebra, and that is a mess. What you can do, though, is parameterize post-Newtonian, at which post-Newtonian order the first corrections in the algebra start. Because what happened with spin is that, for instance, Fix is J, is proportional to Sij, already in flat space. This is already flat space, because you cannot define, because you cannot go to the local frame. When you define in quantum mechanics, remember, the position operator, you have this Newton being operator that hasn't spread. It's basically exactly this reason, this guy's don't commute. So you can go to a different gauge, which is not this one, which is the Newton linear gauge, which is not exactly, so basically S new zero. You have to pick some direction, so it's not Lorentz invariant. So you break the Lorentz invariant. You do it anyway because you're choosing a frame where you're doing the post-Newtonian expansion. In this frame, this guy goes away, and there are higher order corrections. You can know the post-Newtonian expansion, and power kind of which order those corrections stuff. That's what I did in my first paper, it must have been messy, until I realized that you could do it this way, it's much simpler. But ultimately, all I need is a coupling. How gravity is going to couple to spin? And then if I ask you, I give you this degree of freedom, which is SAB. How are you going to couple to gravity? Well, you have these two indices, spin defined in the local frame. What do I have? Is I have this term. Because it's an asymmetry. Then this can enter in my Lagrangian. The problem is, how do I get the equation of motion? I need some dynamic for S. So what I do is some partial Legendre transformation, and I get this as a P. And then when I want to compute the equation of motion, S dot is like, it's like that action commutator with spin. I should call it different. But you know what I mean. I mean, call it Lucian commutator with spin. So that's how you get the equation of motion. You should have to use some canonical SO3-1 algebra. But that's a technicality. The point is here, for instance, how do I deal with finite size effect? So this is an S-square term here. How do I do the matching? Coupled to the one-point function, read off the metric, read off curve solution. Use the matching, this is something that is one-half length, because it's just the quadrupole of the curve solution, which is as a half. And then you can go on and compute the correction, the finite side correction. If this is not a Newton star, if this is not a black hole, it's a Newton star, this is not a half. It's a different number. And then you can compute higher order correction. And that's something that we did, Aaron and I computed. Up to 3 billion order, and then something that you can measure, and again, you can test whether the extraction of this coefficient for the case of the neutron star is correct or not. We compute it next to the enough. So this is how you introduce spin, how the matching works in that case. And for the case of spin, let me just, okay, in the remainder of the talk, let me just tell you how do we deal with the other two scales that we have in the problem, which are the scale R and the scale lambda. So now we know how to deal the point with the point particle approximation. So we're gonna now have this series where the Lagrangian for these guys are gonna be Wallace. And they're going to be embodied with some higher order multiples, like the C's, the E squares, all those terms in the action. Because what I said at the beginning, trying to motivate, we integrate out those degrees of freedom, we shrink that the body to a point, we know to power count the corrections. That's the first effective theory. Now, how do we deal with the second? We have some scale R, and we have some radiation scale lambda. It's R over B. So you know R is much, much less than lambda. So this is gravity. It's the same gravity that's responsible for the binding here. It's the same gravity that's radiating gravitational waves away. So the point is that we have some, that we're doing perturbations around flat space. So we have some decomposition again of the metric this is just, we're going to introduce M Planck's and H bars and stuff like that, but ultimately everything is going to be just G Newton, right? And all the H bars drop away, we just work on H bar equal to 1. There is not really H bars anywhere. This is all classical. And people ask me, why do I put a Planck here? I can put this G. So now this guy is responsible for both modes, for the binding mode and the radiation mode. So we can split it. We're going to call H minute the potential mode, which is this off-shell mode, which is responsible for the binding. I'm going to call H bar mu nu the radiation mode, which is this mode responsible, the typical mode, right? The typical momentum in this guy. As I say, the mean is v over r. The typical momentum in this guy is 1 over r, and it's an off-shell guy that has some mutuality v over r. So what we did here is some splitting, nothing else, right? So I'm separating the field in something, the bar is much slower than this guy, the bar is very fast, right, in space. So what's the idea here is that, okay, this is again integrating out the short distance physics. So for the scale of the radiation, which serves as a background, this mode is very fast. It's like short distance physics. So we can get rid of it. We integrate out. So, and we're going to treat now the binary as a point binary. So we shrink the binary to a point. Couple now to this guy, which is our radiation mode, for which the binary looks like a point. So it's exactly equivalent. It's the same thing we did with the finite size effect, because we have some probe. The probe now for the binary is a field which is much, much slower. It varies in a much longer scale. So we can treat it as a backup. So what we do is, again, path interval. And we have to get rid, like that's written there, we have to get rid of the fast varying field. This is exactly equivalent when you're doing field theory. This is the Wilsonian approach. You have some modes that are very energetic, you integrate them out, you get an effective action, which is the interaction with the long wavelength modes, which are the everyday physics, if you want. So while we can do this, there is more. Okay, I don't want to go into technical detail, but this is something that you can do to all orders, and why that makes sense. I can motivate it. What am I doing here? I'm something that is well known in the effective theory community, and something that goes by the name of method of regions, which is.
What is this like?
Oh, I'm sorry. That's much better. Oh.
This is too much.
Well, I don't know about you.
No.
Okay. That's. So let's compute. Let's say we don't have any non-linearity. We have a linear field, some scalar field couple to the masses, right? So we have some couple M of phi, right? We can do the same trick because you can radiate this guy away too. So there is, when you compute the effective action, there is some interaction here, which has some propagator. And that propagator has the typical form for a massless field, which goes something like this. So there is a region here where this guy goes on shell, which is the region where this guy radiates, which is when p is order p0, which is p over r. But there is the other region here, which is the region responsible for the binding of the system, which what I'm saying is that it varies in a much longer scale. I can expand this guy. So if I expand this propagator, what I have is something that I didn't know that goes like this, what will give me the Newtonian interaction, and then I have higher order corrections, right? What I did, which is just like this one. So I have a term, 1 plus p0 squared over p squared plus w. So what I'm doing here is just doing this expansion at the level of the Lagrangian, which is separating the mean order mode, which is my potential mode, which is responsible for the instantaneous interaction. This you do the Fourier transform and you get the 1 over r. Right? So this is the method of region at the level of the Feynman diagrams. This is just like when you do an effective field theory, it's just recognizing your theory, which are the relevant degrees of freedom, the relevant modes. Right? And now, case. This is much simpler than much more complicated theories like self-collinear effective theory and things of that nature, when you have many different soft-gravitons, ultra-soft-gravitons, blah, blah, blah. Here, it's very simple, potential radiation. Where am I here? Okay. So what we're going to do is we're going to get rid of this guy, meaning we're going to solve for all the potential modes. I'm going to do it perturbatively. So at this order, my propagator is going to be just an instantaneous propagator. So that H over there, the big H potential, is going to have a propagator which is instantaneous. So our H pushes on over P squared in schematic here. So we can integrate it out. But the idea is we don't want to lose gauge invariance. So we're going to use the background field method where we treat the radiation now as a background. And it's no flat space anymore, because this guy lives in the field of the radiation. So, and the radiation enters in the background. So this is the gauge fixing now in the background field method. This is just the covariant derivative with respect to the radiation field. And integrating out the potential modes means just solve a bunch of Feynman diagrams. It's just to get rid of the potential mode. It's calculate the path integral, which is literally computing the Feynman diagrams in the vacuum to vacuum amplitude in the presence of a source. And the sources are the binaries, the objects. So this is what we get. So the first term is what I explained there. This P0 is cutting my finger here? No. So this term over here is this correction here, which is a correction to instantaneity, because this guy, as I mentioned here, he propagates instantaneously at given order. The propagation is instantaneous. But it's not true, there is a correction. This correction is a subleading, when you span the bulk action, the Einstein action, there's a term that goes like B0H, B0H. This is a subleading term, it goes like B squared. So I represent it this way, like a mass insertion if you want, but it's time dependent. There is a correction to the propagation, which is nothing but this guy over here. Now there are non-linearities, because now this is not true, this is just like a scalar field that you can only get the linear piece and you're done. Oh, by the way, I mean, you know how to compute these things, right? You compute all the 1PI diagrams. Because, I mean, what I'm computing here at the order, for instance, is this guy. Like the guy over there. Like that would be the order, V0, V0, which is just Newtonian gravity. It's just using this propagator, which just gives me Fourier transform, whatever. That's very simple. So you can compute this diagram. Because they exponentiate, right? The effective action is e to the I effective action. So when you compute the partition function, all this guy is square over 2 factorial, blah, 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 they exponentiate. When really matters, it's like e to the I, just this term. Right? So when you compute the effective action, you only compute those terms that are connected. So next to linear order, you have to compute corrections to the instantaneous interaction. I mean, do you understand this case you put the Newtonian gravity? Because it's very simple, the interaction, which has come from n d tau, give you a coupling to the 0, 0, and mass 1 and mass 2, and then you have some potential mode, and you know how they propagate is 1 over p, so you have m1, m2, and so Fourier transform of 1 over p, give you m1, m2 over r. And that's the contribution to the effective action. Simple. Higher orders is the same technique, just more complicated Feynman diagrams because you have no linearity. And then you have corrections to instantaneity and corrections to the wall line because the d tau has all sort of powers of velocity. And also, like this Siegel diagram comes from there, right? Because it's a square root, you have 1 a 0 0, when you span this guy, you're going to have a 0 0 square, right? And that guy's going to give you this guy. And once you know in defective theory, you can power count because you know exactly which order things enter. You know which order each one of these diagrams is going to contribute. All of this guy contributes at order b squared. And this is Einstein. That's the Lagrangian for the 1PN that you can write down in one slide. Whereas if you go on, I don't have that slide here. I used to have it in my talk. And you see the original Einstein for Homer derivation is very complicated. So we're reducing the amount of work considerably. And let me show you, for instance, here. This is what we computed at 3 p.m., like the spin Hamiltonian for the case of two spinning bodies, which is exactly the same diagrams. This is the beauty of it. It's exactly the same diagrams, because it's a Lagrangian formalism. The only thing you have to correct is how it couples to the Wallman. Spin doesn't affect the propagation, it only affects how it couples to the Wallman. So all I have to do is put spins in the wall lines and compute the same type of diagrams. And something that hadn't been done until very recently, we computed in like 3 pages. So let me show you before I'm almost done. Unfortunately, I cannot talk about this question. It's how do we deal with the radiation part? So once we did this, integrating out the potential mode, we generate something, a contribution to the effective action, which is purely real. It just contributes to the equation of motion. It gives you a Lagrangian. This is nothing but computing these terms literally, because it's a contribution to the effective action. Now, this is an effective action which is gravity coupled to external sources. Now, if you vary the external sources, then the action is minimized. So you can show that how they're going to respond to variation of the sources by minimizing this action. So you can actually compute the equations of motion by minimizing this guy by using it as a Lagrangian. So that's the trick. So that's how you get the equations of motion. Now, how do you get the radiation? Because I haven't told you how to get the radiation. I just told you how to create the potential modes, which are shrinking the binary to a point. Now we have this wall line, which is a wall line for a binary that looks like a point particle coupled to this radiation. We want to get rid of the radiation modes, because ultimately what we measure is this power spectrum. So we want to compute the variation, the energy loss. And that's how we do it. So now we're going to get rid of the radiation mode. So the way we get rid of the radiation mode is a bit technical also, because we have a bit of a problem is that gravity is nonlinear. So we can just have radiation off the wall line, just the guy just radiates. Or it can radiate off the graviton itself. And now we have a hard guy and a soft guy. So if we want to retain power counting, we have to do a multiple expansion because this guy has all the powers of B, the same here. So you have to do a multiple expansion of the source. So you choose, since we shrink the wall line to a point, it's like choosing some center of mass, some point, and do a multiple expansion. So we're going to treat now the binary as a wall line around the center of mass point where we do the multiple expansion, and we generate a bunch of terms. Some of the terms are going to come from the multiple expansion, some of the terms are going to come from computing these diagrams, because it can radiate off this guy. When you compute effective action, some coupled to the H00 radiation, it's going to come from this term. And then you reorganize your terms, and you realize because of gauge invariance, because the way we compute it, that it has this form, that it's just coupled to the curvature. And it has some quadruple, which is just this guy, which is just the sum of the distances from the center of mass to the each one of the points in the binary. So if there was a permanent quadrupole, this would be the way we would include it anyway, right? So this is just looks like a point particle couples to some quadrupole, and that's what we know it radiates. There are some other terms in here, but those terms won't radiate because those are constant of the motion. For instance, it will couple to the total angular momentum, but that's time independent. It will couple to the total energy, but that's also time independent. So the first guy that's going to radiate is the quadruple. It's a very well-known GR argument for that. So how do we compute the radiation part? Well, this guy's going to have an imaginary part. That imaginary part is going to give you some decay rate. And this is the usual formula. And the way we compute the imaginary part is you can actually do it. You can compute directly like the graviton emission here and square it and compute the amplitude. Or you just compute the imaginary part this time, you just do the cap, which is just the imaginary part, it's just me importing the guy in a shell. There are some 4 powers of k because this guy, the E has 2 powers of velocity. Then there is a delta function on shell because of the imaginary part, which remember now we can go on shell, and that's when the I epsilon is very important. That's why before we didn't care about it. The imaginary parts, because off shell, the epsilon I don't care. So it's all real. But when we go on shell, now the epsilon really matters because we can go on shell. So we generate a delta function that when you integrate that piece, it's like gives you the 1/2/k. And this is the imaginary part. And using this formula, voila, this is the quadruple. And this is again very simple. You do this to all orders and you can generate the power spectrum to all orders in the positronian expansion. Well, these guys are the derivatives of the wall lines, and the equation of motion for these guys, you know, because you solved for the potential before, you have the equation of motion. This is some kind of adiabatic expansion. So you're doing this in average. If you're gonna do this instantaneously, then you really have to solve for the cell force. So you really have to compute what is the real part of this diagram, because what is the back reaction on itself, and solve a much more complicated dynamics. But on average, if you assume that it doesn't vary much in one period, we can compute the total power radiated and the adiabatic expansion just computing the imaginary part. But we can also compute the cell force. That's the magic of it. And you do that to the order, you're also going to run into divergences, and that's something that, for instance, Walter studied, because you can scale it off a potential gravitation from here, for instance, and that's going to run into divergences too, and then you have infrared divergences, because this will be like scaling off a 1 over r potential that we know is infrared divergent. But you can resummle, I mean, you know this infrared, that observables are infrared safe, so all you have to do is compute infrared safe quantities, and all the infrared divergences go away, but it's not, because you can show that they exponentiate and there's a phase, something that Walter computed, and something very nice that you should follow. This is something I show you. Okay, I don't have much time, but I just want to skim over what I thought I would talk the most, which is this duality. If you stand with me 5 minutes, I'll give you the flavor. So, I told you before that I was going to ignore dissipation, and I was going to treat this, I was going to integrate out those degrees of freedom responsible for the coupling to for the internal degrees of freedom coupled to gravity. So I was going to integrate them out. But if I'm going to deal with absorption, I have to keep some dynamics, because these guys are going to have some time variation that's going to be very important for us to compute the power of absorption. Because how we react to the graviton now is very important. So I cannot get rid of them. If you want, I mean, absorption is like gapless modes, like xenons. So how do I do it in effective theory? I have no idea what's happening here. But how can I parameterize my ignorance? What is the trick here? Well, what I can do is, okay, imagine that it's going to couple to some field, with some strength, to some external perturbation, which is this E and B, which are the light. We could do this in electromagnetism. This is the same problem with electromagnetism, with light. Imagine this E and B, and there's some P and M, some dipole moments. Right? It's exactly the same idea. So there is some dynamics for these guys that's going to be responsible for absorption. But I have no idea. I don't know what's happening inside. So how can I do? Just as a side note, imagine if you integrate out these fields, I mean, you put some Q dot squared term here, you integrate them out, you just get back what you want, which is the final size effect that I talked before. Unless this guy has some there, which, for instance, for a spin, we're going to see that there is a there. So how do I know what's happening here? Well, I can do the same trick again. Let's go to the matching now. But in the matching, we have to keep those degrees of freedom. Those Q are propagating the degrees of freedom. But I don't know what the dynamic is. Well, I don't care. Because matching is going to tell me how this guy is going to react to some external field. Once I know how it reacts to some external field, I can put it in the binary and make a prediction. But now there is some time variation here. So how do we incorporate that time variation? Well, the point is that, for instance, let's go back and compute the same observable as before. In effective theory, this cross-section. But now compute the cross-section for absorption. Something that's well known. Actually, in the low frequency approximation, it's been done. For instance, Starling's thing. And then it's going to be some propagation, because this is time-dependent field. So it's going to have a two-point function. So this two-point function, I don't know. But I can match. I can compute in the full theory and get some frequency dependence of this two-point function, because it's time-dependent. It's not a delta function. It doesn't shrink to a point. And then I go to in the binary and I make a prediction. And let me just... This is the matching, and let me just show you. For instance, for a spin, there's the super radiance effect. When one computes the absorption due to spin, there's an enhancement due to super radiance. Let's not go there. That's the heuristic of super radiance, which is just the second law, if you think about it, because dldm has to be negative. This guy is like less than 1. There's no choice, otherwise you wouldn't obey the second law. You do the matching for a spin, you use a background. because the spin in this is a quadruple, and you do the matching, you compare with the full theory, and then you make a prediction, because now you go to the binary, and then you know how this guy propagates the two-point function, and you can make a prediction that is actually for a spin and enhancement of 3 powers of velocity. You go to the effective action, you compute the effective action, it's proportional to the two-point function that we computed before. Since it's universal, we plug in it here, voila, that's the prediction. It's very simple. This is something computed actually by Eric Poisson. This is the limit of the large math. And it's the same, and if you go read Eric's paper, it's a bit complicated. You can do the same for neutron stars, just that you don't know what the power of absorption is. But once you know, since it's universal, you can make a prediction for neutron stars. And this is very useful because it's an observable that you can measure. You can do all sorts of things, like put in a test particle and calculate the power of absorption in a time-varying space-time, if the space-time is varying. Well, this is something that I use, but I didn't tell you. There is some electric-magnetic duality, even though the background breaks the duality because there's some spin and there is some electric quadruple. One can show that the perturbation still obeys the E to B duality, E to minus B duality. And that's kind of cool. Well, this is what I told you before. You can do the same in electromagnetism and then get the power of absorption with some time-varying dipole. Conclusions. So we have some GR problems using effective field theory techniques. And the whole trick is this idea that we can parameterize our ignorance in terms of high-dimensional terms that you can match. In the case that you know the full theory, you can compute in the full theory, get the matching coefficients, and then you can make a prediction in a more complicated scenario like the binary system. We use techniques from effective field theory and from quantum gravity, if you want, because we're using like perturbations around a given background. You can do the same in any background, like for instance for LISA, because it's much shorter wavelength frequency. We'll have a perturbation around like a Schwarzschild black hole, a very massive, supermassive black hole. So you have to do perturbations around a curved background, but you can do the same techniques. The propagator is a bit more complicated, but the idea, because you can scale off the geometry, you have to write as a series, but in principle, if you can do it numerically, so what? It reduces the amount of work significantly. You can include finite size effects systematically. And dissipation, this is a very nice GREFT duality that because you have time to appreciate it because I just flash over, but this is very nice because there is this coupling in the wall line that is dictated by the symmetries. So there is some global symmetries of the field theory to some isymmetries of the background because there's a spherical symmetry of the Schwarzschild metric. This is the case for flat space, for instance. So this kind of ADS-CFT flavor. And there's matching of the two-point function into the full theory, into the effective theory, which is what you get from matching. And once you know those coefficients, you can make a prediction in the binary system. So there is some kind of duality there, which is very interesting, and it'll be nice to explore what exactly means that you can do this. So it's universal, as I said. Once you have the matching, you can predict. That's the power of effective field theory. If I need an infinite tower of Wilson coefficients, I wouldn't make any prediction. I can cut it at some point of how accurate I want to measure something, and I need n observables, and I can make n plus 1, or the n plus 1 is going to be a prediction. And it's nice because absorption due to super radiance, there is this enhancement, which in my formalism is nice to see because there's an enhancement of the coupling of the quadrupole to the graviton mode. And sorry for going late, but thank you very much for your attention.
Well, a quick one.
Yes.
So these expanding series in field theory are almost always asymptotic.
Yeah, this is probably asymptotic expansion too. Yeah.
Okay, so do you have any argument about what the convergence?
Well, that's a good thing. We have to really compute. For instance, for the case of the massive black hole, one can see that up to a certain order, I forget which, the series becomes asymptotic. I mean, you don't want to go any higher because you're going to lose accuracy. But in the case of equal mass black holes, it's not really known. So you have to go to one more order to really see. But you can actually prove that the number of diagrams is going to grow right? Like factorial. So you're really gonna like blow up at some point. Yes, I mean yes, it's gonna be a problem. But you need to know how small the coefficient is in the next order to really make that assumption that the radius of convection is shrinking, and then you're done.
Yes. So there are various groups which are trying to look at a similar problem without this EFT approach.
Yes.
So how do the results, is there any difference, qualitative difference?
Huge, humongous. So what we do is, what is the idea that what we're doing? This is nothing new. So what people in the 80s realized about solving like strong dynamics is you can use effective considerable techniques, it's like QCD. So you have two quarks, right? And then you have QCD, you have some interactions, some binding energy. The difference now is that these are propagated degrees of freedom, it's a further line, right? So when you compute what I said I was computing, I was putting this guy as a stellar source, the binding. But in the case of effective and serious and QCD, these are quarks, these are propagated degrees of freedom. However, if these are very heavy, you can expand, for instance, one over MB. Of their moving slowly, you can also expand in order B. So these techniques now, you extrapolate to the case of the binary black holes, you just don't do loops, and don't put these external degrees of as propagating degrees of freedom, these are external sources now. And you basically have the same techniques, the same ideas. Now, the people in pure GR, what they compute is directly Einstein equations. And the whole business here is how do you incorporate these delta functions into the stress energy density? Because of the nonlinearities of gravity, right? This guy is nonlinear. How spin is going to couple, for instance, to gravity, blah, blah, blah. How do you make sense of this? And when you iterate, what you... Let's say you have box H equal to T mu 0, and then plus order squared, plus blah, 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 all the nonlinear terms. When you start iterating, you run into divergences. And you have to regularize those divergences. In our method, the regularization is on the wall line. It's an Lagrangian approach. So just include these Wilson coefficients. The way they regularize is very tricky, because they smear out the wall line, and then I don't really know what they do. And that's one of the reasons why we developed these techniques. And the original paper by Aaron Walter was putting that idea forward, that you can regularize the theory much simpler by using a Lagrangian and including these Wilson coefficients than playing with the equations of motion, that regularizing at the level of the equations of motion.
But they can say that, okay, like we are not as ambitious as the EFT program, but we are not making also many approximations.
Well, but they do the exact same approximations. They do V much, much less than one, so there's a post-Newtonian approximation, which is the exact same that we're doing, and we're treating this as a point particle, which is exactly the same as we're doing, systematically, right? So there are some these equations in the post-Newtonian approach, pretty much the same we're doing, but we're separating the scales. When they solve these equations, they have all the scales playing at once. You have the size of the object, you have the potential modes, the radiation modes, all together messed up. So it's much harder.
So the approximations are same. Then why are
the exact same calculation?
Then why the end result is qualitatively different?
No, the end result is exactly the same.
Okay.
We computed Einstein Ife Hofmann Lagrangian. It's the same Einstein Ife Hofmann Lagrangian. So this is a very important point. We're computing the same physics. So this is a 1 PM correction. This is non 1 PM correction, and this is the new result at 3 PM that was recently computed by the German team, and we agreed. And the way they compute is using the AEM formalism, which is highly non-trivial. I cannot read their paper. But for us, it was very simple. But we get the same answer. That's the fun.
And for 3 p.m., we also have the same answer.
Well, 2 p.m., they get the same answer. And that's something that I didn't talk about much. But there's a paper by what I mentioned before, 2 p.m. This is next to me, the NLLO, next to me in order for non-spinning. This is 2 p.m. And they agree with something that was computed in the 70s, for instance, by Chandrasekhar. And the 3 p.m. is something that we're calculating right now, and we should agree with that they computed. But the thing is that this technique already have reproduced most of the results that are known and computed new results in 2-3 years. Whereas people in this business, in the GR business, they spent over 10 years computing 3PM. Okay, they didn't do it all the time, right? But so this is much simpler. This is like similar to this idea of reorganizing your calculation in a way that you can simplify things and split it up.
Okay, thanks again for that.
Thank you.